And I just couldn't create spiritual life on my own. I wanted to kind of be a good person. I wanted my good to outweigh my bad. I was type A, firstborn, president of the youth group. I just wanted to create my own spiritual life, but it wasn't until I recognized my need for Him that then life was created in my soul by the power of the Holy Spirit.
Welcome to the Storytellers Live podcast, where everyday women share stories of hope found in Jesus. I'm Robin, and I am here with Lindy and Katie, and we are your podcast host. And today, we are bringing you a story from Kitty Hurdle, who is with our Oxford, Mississippi community. And Lindy, you were there.
I was there, and I cannot wait for everyone to hear Kitty's wisdom. And we always talk about Patreon, and we just wanted to take a few seconds right now and remind everyone what Patreon is. It is simply being a patron of the Storytellers Live podcast, which means that you like the content that we're offering and that you want to access more content. And you can simply click on our link in our show notes or go to our website at storytellerslive.org, and you simply pay $5 or $10 a month and you receive extra content like bonus stories and continue the conversation and story within the story where you hear more from our storytellers. And this simply helps us keep the lights on around here and pay for the expenses associated with the podcast. So join us over on Patreon. Again, you can click the link in our show notes. Katie, tell us about Kitty.
I know. We love our Patreon members, by the way. We love being able to be in community with them as well. Well, you know, guys, Kitty's story is really just a beautiful picture of how God meets us in our life experiences and grows us in our relationship with Him. Her story has layers of spiritual pride, infertility, foster care, adoption, relational trauma. But throughout it all, you're going to see God weaving this theme of, do you trust me? And I know that's a question that a lot of us need to ask ourselves. You know, am I trusting God? And I think Kitty's story is going to help you see that there's just no circumstance in your life that He cannot meet you in and bring you freedom from. So here's Kitty.
Yeah, my name is Kitty Hurdle. I've lived in Oxford for 11 years. I have one husband and two children. Joel Hurdle, he's on staff with crew. We work together. I say I sleep with my boss. And so that's fun. And then I have a 17-year-old son and a 14-year-old daughter and a golden retriever named Duke. So we love Duke. All right. So the first 18 years of my life were very charmed and delightful. I had two parents and a sister who, if James Dobson, who ran Focus on the Family, was like the uber Christian parenting guy, if he said to do it, my parents were doing it. We were memorizing all these Bible verses. Like, my childhood was extremely charmed and sweet. But really, for the first 18 years of my life represented kind of like a furnished apartment. I don't know if you've ever lived in a furnished apartment, if you were just needing a 6-month rental, but the couch is there. It's not super cute, but the couch is there, the bed's there, the curtains, maybe, maybe not. But nobody's paying the electricity bill. No one's paying the water bill. It's just all the things are in the apartment. And that is very much how my spiritual life was. I knew God loved me. I knew that He sent Jesus to die on the cross for people's sins. I'm like, it was kind of like the womp, womp, womp peanut gallery. I knew it. But it was much like the furnished apartment where the furniture was there, but no one was paying the water bills until I came to college. Went to Marshall University. I cheered there. I had just had my heart broken by the high school boyfriend. And so I was like, well, if he don't like me, I'm going to get everybody else to like me. Ended up, college was everything I said I would never do. Check every one of those boxes. And so it wasn't until that first freshman year in college where a girl named Kristen, she was a soccer player, and I don't know if you know soccer players versus cheerleaders, but they don't have a ton in common. We did have the love for 90s rap. That was like the one thing that we had in common. So we would bump music, drive around town, and she would tell me about God's love. I was like, why is she telling me all this? I know all this. I've got the couch, I got the bed, I got the lamps. I know all of this. But it wasn't until she actually kind of called me as on the carpet with my sin and pointed out the fact I had done everything I had said I would never do, that God really put glasses on my eyes to see my need for him. I was like, oh my gosh, he died for me. He actually loved me, not a better version of myself, because I literally just thought my good needed to outweigh my bad. So if I'm going to make out with somebody, then I should go to 13 Bible studies to try to make up for that. And so that was like my spiritual life. But I was so annoyed that she was telling me all these things that I already knew. And I just couldn't create spiritual life on my own. I wanted to kind of be a good person. I wanted my good to outweigh my bad. I was type A, firstborn, president of the youth group. I just wanted to create my own spiritual life, but it wasn't until I recognized my need for him that then life was created in my soul by the power of the Holy Spirit. And so that was huge. That was life-changing. That was kind of the first 18 years. But when I graduated college, I remembered thinking, these people who work with college students and do ministry, they get to hang out with cool people like me. They get to travel the world. They get to tell people about Jesus. I'm going to do that job. So I decided I would intern with a ministry called Campus Crusade for Christ. Did that for a year, and then a year has now turned into 20. So that's fun. But my first job right out of college was in Charlotte, North Carolina. There's 36 different campuses in the Charlotte area. And so me and a team of, I think, six others, we would go to all these campuses. We were kind of like drug reps for Jesus. And we would drive our cars to these little community colleges and we'd start Bible studies. And I mean, I had a janitor at one point leading a Bible study who like didn't even bring her teeth to come lead the Bible study. But she just gummed her way through it. And it was beautiful. And it was like we were taking Jesus to the world. And it was so fun. And I just kind of like went Christian boss lady a little bit. And I was like, I don't need no man. This is so good. I'm going to tell people about Jesus. Of course, around about that time, Hurricane Katrina happened. And I was assigned to take a team of college students to go do hurricane relief. I had a very bad attitude because I wanted to go to the beach, which is where all the other campus ministries and missionaries were going. But instead, they were like, no, you're going to go to do Hurricane Katrina. So we go, we sleep in circus tents, kind of like, yeah, really actually circus tents. We take showers in the back of Hotty Toddy Potties, but way worse than Hotty Toddy Potties. Those were like bougie compared to these semi-truck trailer things we were taking showers in, covered head to toe in bug bites. It was bad. So we had those like restaurant heaters that would cover a little portion of our tents where we would sleep at night. But of course, about 1 a.m., they would go out of propane. Me and my retainer with my ponytail on the top of my head, I'd go over to the boys' tent. I'd be like, can somebody please come fix our heater? We're freezing. And this very handsome Sigma Chi from Ole Miss would get up out of his cot and he would come over and he'd put propane in our tank. And anyway, I was like, okay, that guy's my crush for the week. I am like, that is my flavor of the week. I'm going to crush on him. I even remember writing in my journal, why am I so distracted by this kid? Because I was on staff and he was a college student. Why am I so distracted by this kid? It would be so weird if we ended up together. Okay, so you see where this is going. Did Hurricane Katrina, very much crushed on him. And right before we left, he ended up getting my contact information. It was very eHarmony-ish. He was the first person I ever texted. Like, we didn't, it was old school. We didn't have really the internet. We had these big chunky computers, you know. It became kind of like You've Got Mail a little bit, just fell in love with him. But in the back of my mind, I'm like, wait, a man is supposed to slow me down. I don't really want to do this whole thing. But within like 3 months, I was like, if that man does not ask me to marry him, I'm going to be real mad. We dated for 6 months. We were engaged for 6 months. And then we got married in August that year, like to the exact date of when we had started dating. So that was kind of fun. If we could have left our wedding and he could have scooped up a baby on the last pew of the church, he would have been so happy. However, if men were going to slow me down, children were definitely going to slow me down. I was like, no, no, no. We need to go tell people about Jesus. We do not need to be wiping bottoms. But around probably year two of our marriage, we started trying to conceive a child. Nothing was happening. I was like, huh, that's kind of weird. Year two rolled around of trying to conceive. And I was like, oh, that's kind of weird. So then we started like going to doctors. And doctors were like, no, nothing's wrong. Nothing's happening at all. You're totally good to go. But I would start being really sad when people would announce pregnancies on the internet. And I would not be able to hug my friends with pregnant bellies because their convex tummies made me feel so empty and concave. We started seeing some fertility treatments. And y'all, I don't know if anybody in this room has ever done that thing, but like shooting yourself with needles in your stomach and actually going into blind hormonal rages 24 hours a day is probably the worst thing ever. And so we did a lot of different fertility treatments. It was draining emotionally. It was draining physically. It was draining financially. It was just really, really sad. And I started to get super disappointed with God. Like, I would raise this child to know Jesus. What is the deal? And I would see, you know, like we had college students who expected and they didn't, they terminated their baby's lives. And I would just be like, I would take that child. I would raise, you know. So I just got into this, God, basically, you owe me. You owe me because I would do it the right way. And so there was just a lot of anger, a lot of pride, a lot of disappointment. And by about year four of walking through infertility, I was just ticked. People would say things that would try to comfort me, and I just was like, that's not comforting at all. People would say things, they would be like, oh, Jesus can sympathize with our weakness. He understands what you're going through. I'm like, Jesus did not have a period. He does not understand at all, actually. And my sweet Sigma Chi husband, no, he lovingly said to me, hey, you know, God actually knows what it feels like to have children who are not yet His. He knows what it feels like to long for His children to be His own, and they're not yet His. And I was like, okay, whoa. And so that right there, to know that the God of the universe could sympathize with my weakness, even though He doesn't have a monthly cycle, was probably the most profound part of our infertility journey, that God needed to speak that to my heart tenderly in the midst of my anger, pride, annoyances. So we began to start praying like, okay, if this ain't the thing, can you just give us a sign? We're not real big sign people, but I was like, we need a sign because we're spending all this money and all this time and all this effort. My stomach looks like a pincushion. And so the next day we were to go and find out some results of some sort of something we were doing. So we were finding out results. It had not been successful. It was terrible. The doctor said to us, I don't know if you believe in the man upstairs, but I think he's giving you a sign that means you should probably stop doing all this. This is like your fourth attempt at this. You should stop. You should pursue adoption if you're comfortable with that. And we had always thought, oh, maybe we'll adopt sometime, but we wanted to have our own children first. Also, if anyone's ever walking through infertility, don't say, oh, your own children, because that really hurts their feelings. But anyway, so we wanted to have our own children first. But because that was our sign that we had prayed for, we were like, okay, we will step out into maybe the option and the journey of adoption. The sexy thing to do at the time was to adopt a child from Africa or China. And that was like the longing of my heart. I was like, okay, that's what we'll do. It'll be great. And in the back of my mind, I was like, the one thing we will never do is foster care to adopt, because those kids are older. They got a lot of issues. We've never parented before. We'll let them go to someone else's family who knows what to do about that. So we pursued adopting internationally. I'm 30 at this point. So we're 30, but he's only 28. I think he had to be 30 to adopt from one of them. The finances were crazy. Like, there were just all these barriers. You were going to have to wait another 5 years to get a child from overseas at this point. And so we were like, okay, that's not it. So then we were like, infant adoption, go to the hospital and you go home with the baby. But there were like 20 families waiting and there were no children. And so we were like, dang it. Okay. And then we were like, well, we have to go, I guess, do our due diligence to hear about the foster care system. So we went to the Department of Social Services, which is a very black and white experience. It is not trying to emotionally whip you up. It is just basically like, get your fingerprint, move on to the next person. And it is very rote and mechanical and sad. But for whatever reason, the Holy Spirit came to the Department of Social Services. And as the presenter was explaining fostering to adopt, Joel and I are weeping. We're like, there are real children who really want a family. And there's really a family who really want children. We're just going to try to do this. And this could be crazy. So we made that decision to foster, and we didn't know what we were getting ourselves into. In fact, like, you have to check a list of what you're willing to take. And we were like, this is so awful. This feels like you're playing God as far as what disabilities you'd be willing to take, or ethnic diversity, or, and like all of this stuff. And we're like, we'll just take anything. We can be a blessing to a child, then just put us down for it. And so we tried to make our options that we would get a baby, because we were like, we just wanted to start from ground zero. That process took 6 months to do paperwork. Then the day we turned it in, it was a hot, steamy day in July. We turned in all our final paperwork and we get a phone call that day. And it was like, Mrs. Hurdle, I think I have a baby for you, but maybe two. I'm not really sure. I'll call you back. And I was like, excuse me? You have a baby for me. Maybe one, perhaps two. What is happening? So I am like scrubbing my kitchen, because I know my husband's in a meeting. I can't call him at the moment. I am scrubbing my kitchen. It's the cleanest my house has ever been. He walks in the door. I'm like, we got a phone call. What do you mean? One, maybe two. We don't know. That's not a thing. they wait 4 more hours to call us, and then they switch from baby to, we have an adorable 3-year-old little girl, and we're like, that's great. That's so exciting. It's not a baby, but whatever, whatever. And then they were like, and she has a 6-year-old brother. And we were like, excuse me? That's a kindergartner. What is happening? I don't even know what to say to a kindergartner. Fast forward, my mentor, her best friend, was the head psychologist for the foster care system. Didn't know it at the time, but she said, as soon as you get a name or a case number, call me. We'll look at the paperwork. We'll see if it's a good match. After they had read all the background, we went from like super elated to completely deflated. We were like, oh my gosh, this is so sad. This is so terrible. Like the background on these children is absolutely horrible. Would we even be capable of parenting? We don't know. And so anyway, we call Miss Robin and she gets really quiet. And I'm like, well, I don't want to like get you in trouble at work or break HIPAA or do something wrong. You don't have to tell me anything. And she's like, well, actually, he, who had the longest sheet on him because he's 6, he has been in my home for 2 weeks. His foster family has been on a cruise. I have him on my lap right now. And she's like, listen, I don't have to parent him for the next 18 years or till he's 18. But I just want you to know, if you saw you on paper, you would not want you either. And I was like, okay, she is not wrong. And I needed to hear that again, just like I needed to hear originally, like that my sin was what kept me from God. I needed to hear that my own like desire for maybe like a designer child that looks great on paper, like that was spiritual pride too, keeping me away from him. And the same way I couldn't produce spiritual life, I couldn't produce family life on my own. And it was like the one thing I couldn't make happen. If you want to get a job, you can pretty much go get a job. If you want to find a life partner, like you can, like you could lower your standards and find somebody. Don't do that. But you could if you really, you know, so, but like you can make most things in life happen. You cannot create life. And so it was like over and over, will you trust me to create spiritual life? Will you trust me to create physical life? So we're, Robin's like, he's sitting here on my lap. She's like, why don't you just come swim at my house tomorrow and you can just be my friend and you're just coming to swim. She's like, but his favorite color is blue, so you probably want to go buy a blue bathing suit. I was like, okay, blue bathing suit, Target, let's go. Anyway, we show up the next morning at the pool. We fall in love with this child. And she had told us, she's like, he has a heart, he has eyes, he has a soul, like you're going to love him. But she's like, I don't have to raise him, but you just need to come see. Fell in love with that child. The next day, just so happened that the foster family came back from their cruise. She had been following me on Twitter. Is Twitter even a thing anymore? No, I don't know. But somehow she was like, hey, I heard through the grapevine that you might be getting these children. You want to come meet the girl? And I'm like, yes. So we meet her, obsessed. Fell in love with her as well. So fast forward, we take them into our home. They can come and stay with you for 2 weeks. And then you have to take them to the foster family and they have to like reevaluate and do all this paperwork. Which later then my child's like, do you remember when you kept me for 2 weeks and then you took me back? So thankfully that came out and I was able to coach her through what actually happened. But anyway, it was a bumpy ride. Foster care and adoption is no joke. And so I was Mrs. Joel for the longest time because they were both obsessed with my husband. I was Mrs. Joel. And for 9 months, they were our foster kids. We would have to take them every 2 weeks to visit their biological family. Sometimes they would show up. Sometimes they wouldn't. It was really tough and really hard. But because every night, these two little kids are looking at us from their little bedroom saying, are you going to keep us? Are we going to be a family forever? And like, I couldn't say that. I couldn't say yes or no because you couldn't plan it out. And so we would just say to them, we are begging that God would say yes and that he would make us a forever family. Again, God was saying to me, like, will you trust me? Will you trust me to create life? Because you cannot create family life, physical life, spiritual life. You can't create it, but will you trust me? And so 9 months later, 9 months of paperwork, 9 months of a foster care situation. We stood before the judge. Then it was a finalized adoption, which is just kind of cool that like two kids both had 9 months of, you know, not actually natal experience, but kind of. And so we stood there before the judge, foster care family, police officers, social workers, CASA workers, guardian ad litems, two kids who are ridden with anxiety because they don't know what's happening. I mean, I got one peeking down his cafeteria food all down my outfit. And I'm like, this is not what the photography was, like photograph person was supposed to come and see. But it worked out. And so we created a new family tree. Like God created life. And he did what we had doubted that he could do, he did. And so really cool things happened those first 5 years of having our kids. I remember the day that the court case was happening, I was going to Chick-fil-A to meet with a college student, and the social worker called and she's like, "Do you want to know anything else about their past? Because once the adoption is finalized, you can no longer know anything else about their past." And I was like, "I don't know what else to ask. Is there anything you think I should know?" And she's like, "Nope, let's close the case. Let's be done." And so then I would go sit down with a girl named Lucy at Chick-fil-A, and she would say to me, "I am really struggling with my past. I cannot get over my past, all the things I've done." And I'm able to say to her, "When God adopts us into his family, the court case is closed. We have no business going back and looking at the past of what the enemy tried to steal, kill, and destroy. Once we are in Christ, we are a new creation, and the old is gone and the new has come, and our court case is closed." And so just that picture of adoption, that God will never leave us or forsake us. He's not going to take us back after 2 weeks. He's not going to do that. And he's never going to abandon us. Like, all of these things just became like fire in my soul. And I was like, "Oh my gosh, this is so real. This is so beautiful." So I feel like I understood the gospel as a result of the adoption process. There was a ton of therapies and sleeplessness. I think my kids had a Google Doc where one would sign up for one shift in the night and the other one would sign up for the next. It was terrible. But when you've been abused for crying in the night or neglected or you haven't had food, like, you just function out of trauma, and that's all you know to do. And so it was a really, really rough, especially first 5 years. I apologize to every crew person that worked for us, because I'm like, "I was blacked out and I'm really, really sorry." God used it. And then we heard an opportunity to come to Oxford, that a job opening had come up with crew, and we were pretty desperate for backup. And so we had grandparents 50 minutes away, and we were like, "Yes, take us to Oxford." I never would have thought I was going to live in Mississippi a day in my life, but here we go. My husband had gone here, so it was fine. And so when I moved to Oxford, I judged the heck out of this town. I don't know if you've moved to Oxford or if you've grown up here your whole life, but I judge this town because Oxonians like to think that this is the center of the universe, and they call it the Velvet Ditch for a reason, and people don't ever want to leave. And everybody had their supper clubs and everybody had their Christmas parties, and I felt on the outside majorly. And so I just judged this place for a good solid year. I was like, "These people are crazy." And then the next year I had the great idea, I'm going to be just like this town. I'm going to fit in. I'm going to buy all the clothes. I'm going to try to make my house whatever. I'm going to be just like this town, which is a very expensive pastime. And on a missionary salary, you can't do that. But the third year I lived here, our pastor at the time said, he was preaching out of 1 Peter. He said, "You are not a citizen of Oxford. You're not even a citizen of Jackson," which that really stepped on some toes. "You are a citizen of heaven. And if you're a citizen of heaven," then I applied it to myself. I can be my own weird, quirky self, and I can live in this town, and I can be a gospel ministry to the people he's put in front of us, which were college students. And so that was a big moment where it just felt like, okay, again, I didn't feel like I could create a life for me here, but God said, "Will you trust me to create a life for you here?" And so just this theme of, "Will you trust me to create life and a home and a family," was again kind of reiterated. Then some things happened within our staff team with our ministry, things that were happening in the secret that just began to cause a lot of friction and a lot of lack of trust. Of course, it was April 2020. I'm like on the last flight out of Havana, Cuba with a mission team. We've not had cell phone service. We didn't know anything that was going on. And then we heard all of a sudden Tom Hanks had some weird virus and that they were canceling the NBA. And we're like, "Wait, what?" And the spring break had been extended. So my husband calls and he's like, "Hey, I just took the kids to Walmart. I handed them a shopping cart. And I said to them, if you've ever seen mom buy it, go put it in the cart and meet me right back here." And so I'm like, "Oh, crap. Okay. All right." He picks me up from the Memphis airport in a mask. I'm like, "What are you doing? What are you doing?" Anyway, y'all lived this, so I don't have to rehash it all. But it's interesting because I think during 2020, so much came out into the light in all of our souls and all of our hearts. My mentor would infamously say that when the tide goes out, you can tell who's been skinny dipping. And so it just revealed a ton about the reality of what was going on just kind of in our work life and in our church life. And so then we kind of for the next 3 years walked through what felt like really just a horrific divorce of relationships and eventually the death of a lot of relationships. And it was so frustrating, again, because I was like, "I can make anything happen. I'm type A. I'm an Enneagram 3. I can do this." And so, like, I would try to win these people to myself, even though I thought I was trying to win them to like Jesus. But I actually think now in retrospect, I was trying to win them to myself. I would get the best lunches rolled out for these staff women. And I would like bring these speakers in. I would just try to love bomb them and try to make them love me. And I wanted to win them instead of trusting that God was going to create new life. He was going to do something out of nothing, which is what he does. And so there was just a ton of hurt and pain. And it made me want to try to control the narrative because awful things were said about us. Awful things were said about our ministry. We ended up in the process of it all feeling like we had lost a lot of our community and our church. And it was truly terrible. But I did a lot of great Christian counseling, which was life-changing, and had a sweet spiritual director. They were dear friends also in town who just put up with a lot of my baggage, which was really huge. And during one session with a spiritual director, she asked me, has there ever been a time where you have felt a pain like this and you just couldn't get over it? And I was like, yes, infertility. And this was relational infertility. Like I couldn't change it. I couldn't make it happen. Once again, God was asking me to trust him to create life. And it was almost like infertility had prepared me for the harder part of just losing so much of our community and just experiencing spiritual pain, which felt deeper than physical pain. Kind of been cool over the last 2.5, 3 years. God has rebirthed this beautiful life within our ministry to college students, but like within my relationship with Joel, and then also in relationship with community and friends, but more so in my heart, feeling like, okay, I can love people without the strings attached of trying to win them. I can love people without the strings attached to try to manipulate a situation or control something. Because as the same way I would try to manipulate and control fertility by doing treatments, nothing that there's anything wrong with that, medical procedures and all that. But I was trying to control and create life in the same way I was trying to do that with even just like my own spiritual growth. In the same way I was trying to do that with our team and our ministry, it was like God just said, I need you to trust me. And so anyway, that was like probably the darkest scene. I'm being a little bit vague because everyone still lives in the zip code. But it was just a realization that changed everything. That once again, God could sympathize with my weakness. God knows what it feels like to hang on a cross and have his friends bail. He knows what that feels like. He knows what it feels like to have rumors and terrible things spread about you. He knows what it feels like to lose his ministry, people he poured into. He just knows what it feels like. And so above and beyond, to know that we have a king who can sympathize with our weakness is by far the most life-changing thing that I feel like is my story to tell, that he can create something out of nothing. He can bring life. He can bring light. And ultimately, he can be trusted. And so that is a little bit of my story. Much sanctification still left to go, much sanctification and holiness still in process, but so much more freedom because of what God has done.
As we said in the intro, I was able to actually go to Oxford and attend this live gathering, and it was such a blessing because it was a true picture of really the mission of storytellers to build community among women. In that room on a Thursday night, you had some college girls that Kitty mentors. You had a mom of one of the college girls that drove from Atlanta because she had heard her daughter talk about Kitty so much. And then you had just women from Oxford who, as you heard Kitty talk about the dynamics in Oxford, you know, those women were looking for community as well. And one girl, I would say girl, maybe she was a lady, came up to me afterwards, and she had adopted through the foster care system and wanted to connect with Kitty because of that. And so they were able to connect at the live gathering. We do want you to check out our live gatherings on our website. If there's one near you, everyone is welcome. And it's just such a beautiful picture of community.
I just love that you were able to be there, Lindy. You know, we always want to be at all of our communities across the Southeast. And I just love that you were able to drive and be there. But I'll tell you, there were so many, as I said at the beginning of the story, those layers to her story. And it just really, it was just that theme of God asking her, as I said at the beginning, do you trust me in this? And the picture that she gave that God creates spiritual life within you and he uses those circumstances for that. And, you know, I just think for those of you who might be walking through a difficult season or you're struggling, whether it's circumstantial or it's physical or mental, that God can use that in your spiritual life to grow you. And it's funny. It's like, you know, I think some people
people might be saying, well, Katie, how do I do that? And I think one of the best ways that you can is to sit with him, repeat his promises back to him. I love the verses in 1 Thessalonians 5:16-18 that just, they're so simple. It's like, rejoice, praise him, give thanks in this. And that's God's will for your life, no matter what you're going through in your circumstances. So maybe use that exercise today if you're in a season of struggling, wondering, what are you doing in this season of my life?
And Kitty even talks about how to address your past. You know, those are great scriptures to sit on. And what if you're the person sitting there saying, God cannot use me. My past is way too messed up. I've done way too much. And the picture that she gave of the case being closed.
Loved it.
I mean, I wrote it down and I thought, here I am, an adoptive mom myself, and I have never thought of it that way, of, hey, once this book is closed, you can never find out information again. And what a picture of the Lord, of like, hey, case closed, this is done. Your past is your past, and he is your future.
Mm. And when Kitty was telling the part of her story where she was talking with her friend, the other social worker or psychiatrist, and they both said, well, no one would want you on paper either. I wish y'all could have been in the room at that moment, because truly there was a shift in the spirit.
Oh, yeah.
No one would want you on paper either. And I just thought to myself, that is true. That is very true. And so just that coupled with exactly what you're saying, Robin, that, you know, because of Christ, he negates all that. Yeah. The past is gone and we are new creatures. And then the other thing that I appreciated about Kitty that I could relate to as a woman is when she was talking about the dynamics in the community. Mm-hmm. And I moved it to Oxford and I judged everybody year one. And then year two, I wanted to be like everyone. And I thought, is that not just a woman? Like, I'm going to sit here and judge you. And then I'm going to try to be like you because I want to fit in.
Yeah.
But just the work that the Lord did in her marriage, in her home, in her heart, and with her own identity.
And I appreciate her vulnerability in sharing the things she did, because let's be honest, we've probably all done at least one of those and maybe not ever said that out loud.
Yes.
So I loved that she shared that she tried really hard to win people over for her instead of Jesus.
Just wanting that acceptance and that likability. And I love the reminder that she said throughout all of that is that, hey, you're not a citizen of Oxford. You're a citizen of heaven. And then she said, so I can be my own quirky self. And I mean, it just does give you this freedom to live as who God created you to be and not try to feel like I've got to fit in with this group and I've got to be this way with this group. Be yourself. And then, as she said, trust God to create life there.
And really, to close this, I don't think I've ever heard someone talk about creating life in so many different facets. Mm-hmm. It was from infertility to creating her own identity, creating life within community and in the church. I mean, she referenced it in so many ways. And so, Kitty, we are so thankful for your story.
Yes.
So thanks for listening today. We know one of these areas spoke to you and will also speak to your friends. This is a great story to pass along to your friends, even to your college or high school kids. You know, if you've got people around you that are younger, this is a great story for everyone to hear. And so we hope you loved it. Thank you. Let us know how God used it in your life by emailing us or sending us a direct message on Instagram. Have a great day, and we will talk to you next week. Bye.